Good afternoon. So last time we started by talking about Y86 encoding and decoding. We showed how you could do it by hand. Basically, you take the table, fill in the blank sort of puzzle. Talked about our concept of building circuits that actually would implement this machine code, going beyond just figuring out by hand what it would do. And we need to talk about how do we build processors, what are our components. We started by talking about wires holding bits. We often talk about bundles of wires, which we'll sort of shorthand refer to as wires connecting things that are actually a bunch of wires, one for each bit, which we'll draw as a single line to keep our diagram simpler. Mentioned combinatorial logic, so our extension of gates, that we would have logic where we put in a value and got out a function of that value after some short delay, just like a gate, but for more general computations. As far as we're concerned in this class, we'll basically assume that we can make a circuit which does any of those operations we might care to do, like addition, figuring out turning a value into one of multiple values for a mux, for example, all those things. We assume we can make some logic to do that, and we're not going to be concerned about exactly what that logic is going to look like. We mentioned about, we can't actually do things that take multiple steps, like our processor is meant to do with instructions, with just combinatorial logic. So we want some way of storing state and moving from one step to the next. We have this idea of logic with a clock, where we have this one clock signal with, in our case, periodic rising edges that tell us to advance to the next step. Without a clock signal, if we wanted to do something like have some circuit which keeps counting up, we need to worry that there's the transient states between values that would confuse us, and we wanted to wait for things to stabilize instead. And the clock lets us do that. The idea is that when there's a rising edge of the clock, we advance to the next step. We wait enough time until the next rising edge for our results of our combinatorial logic to become stable, to not be changing anymore. And then we have the next rising edge and use those results to advance to the next step. And our key component in this was registers. So in a register, it reads in a value, writes out at the rising edge, and outputs that value during the next clock cycle between two rising edges. We also had other types of storage. So one of these was memories, representing like our program memory. And the way these memories worked is that we had this address controlling where we're reading and writing. And for reading, the memories actually worked like combinatorial logic. We put in an address, and we get out the value at that address, just like we're a function of that value. Basically, the memory was just like a gate where we put in an address and got out the value at that. So a very complicated gate. For writing, it worked kind of like a register, that we put in some values indicating what the write was, and it would happen at that rising edge of the clock. So you put in an address and a signal and the actual value, and at the rising edge, it would happen, and we had an extra signal saying whether writing was enabled or not for our data memory, where remember, we don't always want to write. So we had a control for that. We also had register files, which worked somewhat similarly. So the register files we're going to use were designed so for reading, you put in a register number, which can be like 8 for register 8, 9 for register 9, 0 for RAX. We just had a table of numbers, and you get out the value in that register. And then what we called our read ports, and we had two of those. We also had write ports, where you put in a register number and a new value for that. And at the rising edge, just like for a register directly, we would actually update the value of that register. Our register file is what we use to hold our registers, you remember from assembly, but we'd have some additional registers like the program counter that maybe don't show up in assembly. And from these components, we talked about building simple processors, and we got to, one of the big things processors do is that they act differently for different instructions. Sometimes we want to add values, sometimes we don't. So we need to make a decision about that. We need some hardware component to make that decision. Our basic tool for that was something known as a MUX, a multiplexer. And the idea of a MUX is we input multiple choices and something to select between those choices, and it acts like sort of an if-else to decide which of those values to use. So any questions about what we talked about last time before we move on to more simple processors? Okay. So last time we finished up, we had a nop and jump processor. So let's move on to a slightly more complicated processor. Let's have a processor which implements all the move to register instructions. So IRMOVEQ, RRMOVEQ, and MRMOVEQ. So these all have something in common, that they're all going to write a value to register Y. So we can think that one thing we know we're going to have is that we're going to have a MUX to choose between the three possible values that we might be writing in our sort of single cycle processor design. Now, one way you could build this is by saying, well, you could reason from here, I need a MUX for what values I'll be writing, and you could reason, like, work that way to build the processor. A way I like working is to just go instruction by instruction and add on each instruction. And sometimes we'll find out, oh, I implemented IRMOVEQ, and now I want to implement RRMOVEQ, and I need to write a different value there, so I add a MUX. So this set instruction by instruction, and every time you find out, oh, I want to put two different values in that input, like to the register file, you just add a MUX to make that decision. So let's go through that procedure, and I'll start with RRMOVEQ. So what's the first thing we're going to do when executing the RRMOVEQ instruction? As a hint, it's the same thing you do when executing any instruction. If you're doing this by hand, what's the first thing you do? Yeah?
Check the value in RA.
So check the value in RA. We need to read the value in RA. And in order to do that, we need to figure out what is RA. So the first step is actually to get what RA is from the instruction memory. And we know that in our single cycle processor design, the PC always contains the current instruction we're running. So we send that to the instruction memory to get our instruction, and we split it off so we can extract this RA part so we can read that. So I'm going to read from RA in our register file. And to read from RA, I'm going to take a signal with RA, and I'm going to attach that into my register file as, in this case, source A. And I'm saying that when I read from RA, I'm going to get the value of RA here. And for the RRMOVEQ instruction, where do we want that to go? Where should that be connected to? Yeah.
RB.
So we want to assign it to RB. What place on this picture does that involve connecting the output to? Yeah.
The next.
So it's the register file contains RA and RB. And remember, to write to a register, we have a pair of inputs. So this is our register number to write. And this is our value. So we're going to connect it into there, which I think I have drawn separate more neatly on my slide. So that's our RRMOVEQ instruction. We also need to specify what register to write. So we're going to assume that hopefully we split off RB and assign that register number to the register number to write. So this is going to write the value of RA into RB. And I also needlessly at this point am reading from RB, but I didn't need to do that. Okay. So any questions about this? Okay, so that's our move queue. Let's move on to our next instruction, which is IR move queue. So IR move queue does the same thing as RR move queue, except instead of the value of RA, we want to assign the value of V. We want to take this V value and put it in here. If we want two things to go to the same place, depending on the instruction, we need a mux to decide which of those two things. So we're going to add a mux to let us make that decision. And the mux, well, we'll start by adding the mux without adding the IR move queue instruction. So initially, we just say one of the options of the mux is do what we were doing before for IR move queue. And we'll have an additional option for the mux to take the value from the instruction, which I've labeled as the immediate. This is going to be V or D, depending on which of these instructions it is, and send that into the next value of RD. Yeah?
What does that convert opcode? Oh, that's for the...
So the question is, what's the convert opcode? So our mux, remember the way our muxes work, we need to supply 0 or 1. And that's not actually any part of our instruction here. So we need to have some logic which says, OK, we're going to turn a 2 into 0, a 3 into 1, and a 5 into something at some point. So questions about so far? So then we have MR move queue, which is substantially more complicated instruction. So what do we do for MR move queue? Like, what's one thing I need to add for MR move queue? So it's reading from memory, so we better be doing something with our data memory over here. Yeah? Okay, so you want to connect this value of RA into address in. So there are two issues with that. So one issue is that we have D, which affects the address. And we want to take that into account. So we're actually need to add something. A far more subtle issue is that you might say, this RB right here, that must be a typo. It's not. It's really RB and not RA. But it's the right idea. We want to connect something. We want to connect a register value to address in. But we also want to add to it for D, and it actually needs to be RB, not RA, even though that's not the order things are written in the assembly. So not quite this, but we actually need RB. And we need to add D to it. Where can we find D? I guess I have it labeled. D is this immediate value, because it's from the same part of the instruction that V was for IR move queue. So we're going to take that and D, add them together, and that's our addressing. Okay, what do we do with the after that? So we're supplying the data memory, the value of D plus RB, which is the memory address we want to read from. So how do we get the value we're reading? So we're from the data out. So the value is in this data out. And where do I want that to go? What does the MR move queue instruction do with the value it reads from memory? Someone else, perhaps? No. Yeah?
Feed it into the mux as like a third option.
Okay, we're going to feed it into the mux. It's another thing we want to write to the registers. Okay? Am I all set? So what might I be, so you've inferred no. In fact, there are two big things I'm missing here. So one thing I've been missing for a while, and just no one, you know, complained about it yet. The other is a subtlety with this particular mRemove queue instruction. Yeah. Yes, so the destination's RA and not RB, so we need to send RA into here, and that means we need another mux. Okay, and that gives us, if I draw this out here, gives us something like this. So there's our ALU adding the two values together, and our mux to decide between RA and RB. Okay. So there's one other thing I haven't done in this processor yet, which is actually very important, that we've seen before, yeah.
The program counter,
yeah. Right now I'm not setting the program counter to anything. It's not gonna work. So what should I do with the program counter? So what should be, how should that be connected? Yeah. Yeah, so we have, in this, in the case of rRemoveQ, we have 1, 2 bytes, so it's plus 2. In the case of these, we have 10 bytes, 1, 2 plus 8 byte V or D, it's plus 10. So we need to decide between those two options, so we have another mux to choose between that, depending on what the instruction is. So any questions on processor I've built here? Okay, so let's add one more instruction to this, and let's let the remaining move instruction, besides conditional moves, which is rmMoveQ. So register to memory move. So what are we going to do for this? What do we need to change for rmMoveQ? What's missing? So register to memory move. Who can tell me what does that instruction do? If you like, if you're writing a manual for YD6 assembly, what would you say this instruction does? Yeah. Okay, so it takes a value from a register and puts it into memory. Okay, so what do we need to do? Connect, what's something we need to connect in our hardware to make that happen? Yeah?
Data in.
Data in. So this data in signal needs to come from somewhere, and what value do we want for that?
RA.
RA. So we have RA sitting here, and we're going to connect that to our data in. Okay, is there anything else we need to do for this instruction? Yeah?
The destination.
Destination, okay. What should it be?
You have to add 10 to, or D to RB.
We have to add D to RB for the address in? Yeah, okay, so we have to add D to RB. And you could just say, okay, we're gonna have another adder, but if we actually look at what we have here, we have, this is connected to RB, and this is connected to D. Remember, the immediate is VRD. So it turns out that's already there. We got lucky. Well, actually, we didn't get lucky. You may have been wondering, why did our textbook authors do this horrible thing of put RB and RA in the wrong order? Now you've discovered a possible reason that it prevented us from needing to do different things for those two instructions. For the memory address. It's probably why they did that, even though it made this destination E a bit inconvenient. Okay, so we have our memory address and our memory value being set correctly. Is there anything else we're gonna need to do? Yeah?
Our mux needs to send 15 to next.
Okay, send 15 to?
Next.
To next?
Destination,
sorry. To destination, okay. So next is the value. We can have all the 2 to 64 values, but we don't want to actually write anything. So the simplest option for that is we can remember that, oh, if I don't want to write anything, I can just send 15 into here. So I have 15 as another mux option. And that's the easiest way. Another option we could have done is we could say, oh, now that we can write to RA, I'm just going to copy RA into RA. That would be another thing we could have done, though that's a lot less intuitive and not actually what we'll probably do when we actually build processors. But that is, technically, we don't need that 15 because we could copy RA into RA in order to not change anything and still have the instruction behave correctly. So there's one more thing we need to deal with that isn't drawn in this picture like at all, and it's actually pretty important. So we dealt with, oh, the RMoveQ instruction doesn't need to write anything to registers, but we didn't deal with, oh, all the other instructions don't need to write anything to memory. And we need to make sure that we don't, for say, IRMoveQ, we don't want to write a value into memory, even though, yes, there will be a value on this wire and a value on this wire, and therefore an address in here, and there will be a value we read from RA, or there will be actually zero in here. We don't want to start zeroing memory in our IRMoveQ instructions. So we need some way of distinguishing, are we writing memory or not in this instruction? And if you remember when we talked about our data memory, we had a write enable signal to do that. So we're going to have a write enable signal, which is going to be another thing we're going to set based on the opcode. When the opcode is the first 4 bits are 4, we're going to set write enable. Otherwise, we're not going to set it. So something like IRMoveQ doesn't start wiping out memory all of a sudden. So any questions about what I've done here? So this procedure of go instruction by instruction, figure out what needs to change in our processor is usually how I'd like to design processors. And I'm going to go just say, start with a simple set of instructions and just add one by one and figure out where am I doing something that the other instructions aren't. And just change things, add muxes as I need to go. There's another strategy we could use, which is we could try to like do this all at once. So we could try to say, rather than worrying about instruction by instruction, I could worry sort of component by component. And this is what our textbook authors say. Is that they say, rather, you know, instead of going through each instruction and just building this up and having the whole processor to deal with, let's just deal with all the instructions, but only like worry about a single part of the processor. Like only worry about like what registers are we supposed to read? Where does that come from? Or what's the ALU doing that does the adds? Where does its values come from? Only worry about that part at once and just go through all the processors. And this is the notion where our textbook authors will take our processor like this and divide it up into stages. So the stages are a way at this point for you to think of the processor sort of piece by piece, and you can worry about what happens in this piece for every instruction without thinking about the other pieces at the same time. It's a conceptual way of dividing up the processor. Later on, we're going to use these stages to actually design a different type of processor, which doesn't execute one instruction per cycle, and the stages will have more meaning. But for now, it's just a conceptual division that might help you think about separating your processor design into separate things you can work on independently. So you can say, you know, work on the write back part and only worry about what value am I writing back and does it come from the register file or the instruction or memory. And separately from worrying about what does memory do rather than thinking about it all at once. And these are the stages our textbook has chosen. I've just drawn the parts of the circuit responsible for the things our textbook does in each stage. And you might say, oh, that's kind of weird. There's some strange things going on here. So we have our fetch stage, and our textbook says that reading from the instruction is part of the fetch. Okay, that makes sense. We need to fetch it from memory. That's where the name comes from. And also, computing the address of the next instruction is part of the fetch stage, the length of the instruction. So which I have down here. Then the next stage in our textbook's order is the decode stage. And you would think, the decode stage, well, that's where we're actually going to use the opcode and all that stuff. And that's not what it is. The decode stage is where we read from the register file. The name is kind of a historic artifact. You're right to be wonder why would you use that name instead of like register read. But it's a common name you might see elsewhere in addition to our textbook. Then we have the execute stage. The execute stage includes what ALU operation we're doing. So in the case of these move instructions, it's just adding to compute an address. Then we have our memory stage. This is the one which makes the most sense. So it includes everything we do with the data memory, the instruction memory, not a part of that. It's the fetch. And then our write back, which is where we decide what value are we actually changing in registers. And then we have our PC update. PC update is where we decide what's the new PC. For the move instructions, it's always that value we computed in fetch of the address of the next instruction. But if we had something like a jump, then we'd have some choices there. So any questions about these stages? So our textbook's idea is that you look at each of these stages and you say, okay, what does the instruction do in this stage? And that's how you can build your processor, that you can just worry about, do I need a mux here? Do I need, what does this mux need to do? Where does it get its values? And work on the decode stage by itself or the write back stage by itself, and this is how you'll build your processors, the sort of notion our textbook has at this point. So the stages are a conceptual division of the instruction into these pieces. Fetch, where we read the instruction, split it up into its pieces, and compute its length to figure out where the next instruction is. Decode, where we read the register file, despite the name. Execute, where we do arithmetic, that stuff we do with the ALU. It's not all the arithmetic there because like computing the address of the next instruction doesn't happen in execute. We have memory where we access the data memory. Some instructions don't do that, but we still say it's a stage. And we have write back where we actually do the register file write. And then we have our PC update. And for now, these are conceptual division because the way our instructions run is that every cycle, we start the cycle with a rising edge, and our PC changes, and things happen based on where they are in the circuit. So a value comes where our PC goes through our instruction memory, gets split up into pieces, goes through the register file. That's why things happen in the order they do, is based on how the circuit works. And this division, you know, just is to help divide up the work. You'll also notice that there's some stuff which isn't really assigned to a stage at all. Like I didn't draw a box around this convert opcode thing. That's sort of stageless. Okay. So questions about these stages? Okay, so since we know about these stages and we talked about how our processor works, you know. So we have this single cycle design where we execute one instruction every cycle. So let's say we're extending that to execute push RAX. We're using the same style of design, one instruction per cycle. So we're going to start the RAX at a rising edge of the clock and finish it at the next rising edge. We're just going to add muxes and so on to the processor I showed you earlier to make this happen. With our textbook style of design, tell me what order these things happen in. I'll give you a minute or so and you can check with your neighbor and see if you agree on what you think the answer is. Okay, who needs more time? No one, yeah, volunteering at least. So who thinks it's A? B? C? Okay, D? E? Or F? Okay, so this is a tricky question, which is why I'm asking it. And it's kind of a deceptive question. So the slide title states stages in time, but this is in fact not a question about stages. Stages will only make it harder to answer this question. It's really a question about how our components work, how registers, register files, and memory work. And the important thing to know is, well, that we have our, we have a single cycle CPU, which means that we, if this is our clock signal, then we're going to have a rising edge of the clock, which changes the PC, and we start our push queue here, and we're going to finish it at the next rising edge of the clock. So that's, we know that that's how our processor design works. We do everything in one cycle. We don't have multiple steps, which take separate cycles. And everything which reads values, we know works in that combinatorial way. We put in a value, and a short time later, you know, we get a result out, not based on a clock signal. So all the reading happens here at some point. And all our components which update state, like our PC, gets updated when there's a rising edge of the clock. Our register file changes its register values when there's a rising edge of the clock. And our memory changes the values in memory when there's a rising edge of the clock. So all our updates are triggered by this single rising edge. So this is where our writes happen. So answer is, in fact, B. Now, it's true that there's going to be some order in which we could compute the value we're changing memory to, and we compute the address at which we're changing memory, and we compute the new value of RSP, but that's not what the question is asking. And there are ordering constraints. So I just have like this written down as we do all our reading during this time. Obviously, we read things at different times. So for example, we can't read registers until after we read the instruction, just because we need to know what register to read. But for all the writes, they're all triggered by that single rising edge. So they're all going to happen at approximately the same time. So B was the actual correct answer. The read would have to happen during the clock cycle before that, probably very during the early part of it, because there's other things which need to occur afterwards to compute the values to write and so on. And I bring this up because people really, really want the stages to affect the order things happening. And we'll get to a point where we have a different processor design where that's the case. But right now, that's not going to happen. And you know, just because I drew boxes over this circuit doesn't change the order in which things happen in this circuit. At some point later on, we're going to not just draw boxes over our circuit, we're going to change it so things happen in those as actual steps. Okay, so any questions on this notion of stages? Okay. So now that we know sort of our general technique for building processors, I want to talk about how we actually describe hardware. And so far, I've just drawn pictures on slides, and that's a fine way of describing hardware. And you could even imagine building like processors that way. There's even commercial tools for designing processors that where you like draw the circuit in some tool. These are known as schematic capture tools. But they're not actually very common things to use, at least for processors. You'll usually find them rather inconvenient for building something as complex as a processor. So the most common type of tools people use are things we call hardware description languages, programming languages for hardware. And these are usually a text-based description of the hardware. It has the advantage that like you can use version control that you already have, and it's possibly like easier to move things around. So typically it's a text-based thing. And just like a programming language, it's going to abstract away a lot of details that we're going to have. Details like building arithmetic from gates or building registers from transistors. We're not going to build a register or describe how you build a register from gates. We're going to say, I want a register in this text-based language. We're not going to typically not going to say to how to build an arithmetic operation from gates. We're just going to say, I want to add these two values together. You figure out what gates that is. And our language will hopefully have abstraction so we don't have to worry about details like how do I build registers? How do I build memories? We're just going to say, I want to register a memory, and it's going to include one for us. And the idea is that when we have this text-based description, we can put it through basically a compiler and get out not like a program to run, but a description of how to build my processor that someone could follow and physically build it. So we're going to use something which is basically in this category of tool, but it's not going to be a commercial tool, I'm afraid. So we have a tool called HCLRS. It's built for this course. It assumes you're making a processor. In fact, it's a little more specific than that. It assumes you're making a y86 processor and to run in a simulator. So, like, it's built for this course, so it has some features which are, you know, tied to y86 and tied to the expectation that we're not going to actually build the real hardware but run it in the simulator. But it's sort of, from a high level, similar to what those commercial tools would be, just simpler. So the textbook also has its own HCL language, and our tool HCLRS is based on that. It's a little more flexible, which is why we're going to use it instead, and possibly has better error reporting and things like that. So I'm going to talk about our tool, which might be a bit different from what the textbook describes. It is a bit different from what the textbook describes. I'm going to start by taking the simplest processor I can think of and building it, showing you how to build it in our HCLRS. I'm going to start with a picture of that processor. So here's my NOP CPU. So it runs NOP instructions. So NOP instructions are 1 byte. We need to advance to the next NOP instruction, so we add 1. You might say, gosh, you know, if that's all you're doing, why would you bother reading the instruction? I mean, you aren't using it. And part of HCLRS, assuming you're making a YD6 processor, is that using the instruction memory is mandatory. It's part of that being hard-coded is it requires you to use the instruction memory. So we're going to have to actually read from the instruction memory, even though, and for this toy processor, it isn't actually necessary. Okay. So to write this, I'm first going to start with our program counter. So we need to declare that. And we're going to declare that as a register using this syntax. So we can specify a set of registers. In this case, I'm only listing 1, but I could have had multiple ones. That one register is called DPC. I'm saying it's 64 bits long, and that when we start our simulation, it's going to start at 0. After that, its value is going to be determined by its input from the previous clock cycle. But initially, we need an initial value, so we know how to start things. That's going to be 0. And when I specify this register, I specify, you know, for the set of registers, 2 characters, the first of which must be lowercase, and the second of which must be uppercase. And these are going to be used to name the signals that go in and out of the register. So we have 2 connections for this register. We have its output wires here and its input wires here. And those are going to both have names based on the values P and F. So in particular, the lowercase p side is going to be our input. So our inputs are all going to start with a lowercase p because we declared our register this way. And our outputs from the register are going to start with an uppercase f. And we'll have a name for each of those inputs, which we'll call wires. And one thing I want to do is I want to take this output here of the PC and connect it to its input plus 1. So to compute plus 1. So let's see what that looks like. This is the HCLRS code for that. So I take my input letter underscore and the register name, so P underscore the PC, and that represents this input here. And I attach it to the value of the output plus 1. And notice that because this is a higher level tool, I'm not describing how do I build a plus 1 circuit from gates. I'm just saying add 1 and assume that the tool is going to figure out how to turn that into a hardware description later. Okay, any questions so far? So the next thing I need is I mentioned that the instruction memory is mandatory. We have to use it, or else we're going to get an error. We assume we're making a processor. And the input to the instruction memory is called lowercase pc. I know this is a little confusing with the PC register. We're just using it because our textbook calls it this. You can think of it as, for our single cycle processor, it's always equal to the current address of the instruction we're running, because it's whatever we're fetching from the instruction memory. The output of the instruction memory, which in this case we don't use, is called i10 bytes. Instruction is presumably what the I is for, and it's 10 bytes long because that's the length of our largest Y86 instruction. And we always read that much. We don't always use all of the values on that signal, but we always read that. Okay. So I'm assigning the input to the instruction memory based on the output of our register. So this output is connected to 2 things, to adding 1 and back to the input, and to the instruction memory. Okay. And i10 bytes won't appear in this code because I'm not going to use that value. Okay, so there's one other mandatory component besides the instruction memory, and that's something that our book calls the stat register. And the stat register is something that the simulator uses to know whether to keep going. So this is how we can turn off our processor. In a real processor, like you have some hardware you talk to cut power, we don't have that sort of thing. This is our equivalent of that. So we can pass these constants. There's a predefined constant, stat underscore AOK, which I can assign to the stat signal to say, keep going, I want to keep simulating. There's a constant underscore halt that I could assign to say, I don't want to keep going, stop the simulation. And these are one of a bunch of predefined constants. If you want to know what all the constants are, our description of HTLRS on the website has this list of all the constants. Some of those will come up later. So it's just equivalent to a constant number that's special for our simulator. Okay, and in this case, I'm saying always keep going. I have more knobs to run. Okay, so this is our knob program. So let's look at what it's going to look like to run it. So you're going to download at some point HTLRS as a tarball, and if you run make, you'll build everything in it. And then I have my program prepared to run here. Okay. So there's my program. And when I built everything, you won't have all these files in your directory. I have this HTLRS is the name of the program. So I can run that program, and I can run it on my NOP CPU, and I get the uses message. And the problem is that in order to run it, I need to supply the contents of the instruction memory. That it doesn't know what program I want to run it on, it doesn't know what's in the instruction memory. And I supply that with what I'm labeling as a YO file, Y-O, because that's the extension we're going to use for the initial contents of our instruction memory, which is also the contents of our memory or data memory because they're the same. So I need a program to load. So here's my assembly program in a .ys file. It's a couple knobs. And I need to convert that to the format that we expect to load, the executable format, which is going to be .yo. I can do that by running make nops.yo, which will, in fact, rebuild it. And we can see that make nops.yo runs this tools YAS. I could also run that directly. YAS stands for Y86 assembler. So that produces this .yo file. And unlike normal executables, this is written in a text format so you can read it. So here's our nops.yo file, and you can see it has the actual, you know, an address and the hex value at that address. And the HTLRS tool is going to read those hex values to load memory. There's also some text after this pipe that is not going to be used by the HTLRS simulator. It's just there to make it more readable for your debugging. So now we have something to load into memory. So now I can run my NOP CPU on that. So here I have NOP CPU, the HTL file, and I have the program I want to load, nops.yo. And let's just run that. Okay, so maybe not what you were expecting. So what happened here? Yeah.
I mean, it executed the knob instruction, then it kept going for 9,000 more cycles.
Yes. So we never told the simulation to stop because we didn't implement the halt instruction. So it just kept going. And this is even though we can see here that we read from memory after our program, and the default value of memory that you don't set from your .yo file is zeros. And remember, opcode zero is a halt instruction. So we write a halt instruction, but we don't have anything to interpret the opcode, so we thought it was enough and kept going. So something to note about this output, so you can see that we have the values of registers after every single cycle. Oh, I probably should highlight on the actual screen, you can see. The values of registers after every single cycle. So this is obviously might be helpful if you're debugging a processor that doesn't do what you expect. We have the values in memory in hexadecimal, so address 00, 01, 02, and so on. It's 10. The values in memory that are not set and are just default to zeros aren't shown. So everything that's not listed there is zeros in memory. And we also, before every cycle, have the value that we set for the PC signal, that's the input to the instruction memory, and the decoding of the machine code that was loaded as a Y86 instruction. That's to help you debug, just because our HTLRS realized that you loaded the halt instruction doesn't mean that you implemented a halt instruction and you'll actually halt. And the same is going to be true for every single other instruction. Okay, so any questions about the output you see here? Okay. So in that case, okay, so let's try to fix this, quote unquote, and implement a CPU that can do nops and halt instructions so it will actually stop. And to do that, what we need to do is remember that the stat register said whether to keep going, so we're going to choose with a mux what thing we want the stat register to do. Do you want it to keep going? That's stat AOK. Do you want it to halt? And we have this other signal labeled INS, which stands for invalid instruction. So that status and a bunch of other statuses like it are going to do the same thing as halt, but the simulator will print a different message. It will tell you it stopped with an invalid instruction instead of it halted. So we're going to need to figure out how to write, oh, I want to set stat to sometimes stat AOK, sometimes stat halt, and sometimes that. And we have a special syntax for that, known as, in our book, as a case expression. We'll often call these muxes for short, which because they're used to implement a mux. And it consists of an open square brace and a list of options. Each option has before colon a condition, followed by the value, and then a semicolon. And these are evaluated in order. So if x is 5, we're going to say if x is 5, then the result is 1. We don't care that 5 is also greater than 2, we don't get there. If x is 6, we say x 6 is not 5, 6 is in the set 0, 6, so we output 2. If x is 3, we say x is in 5, 3 is in 5, 3 isn't in this 0, 6, and 3 is, in fact, greater than 2, so we output 3. Same thing with 4. And if x is 1, we say 1 is in 5, 1 isn't in the set 0 or 6, 1 isn't greater than 2, so we go to this default case and we say 1 colon, 1 is always true, just like in C, 0 is the false value, and we say, okay, then we are going to give a result of 4. So these are evaluated in order. You can think of this as a bunch of if, else if sort of shorthand. So any questions? I have here, yeah.
If you don't have like a behavior defined for a certain number, like if the 1, 4 wasn't there and the input was 1, would it just like?
So the question is, what happens if I don't have a behavior defined? So we have chosen that you are required to have a default case or it won't compile. In prior semesters, we've said that if you don't have a default case, it goes defaults to 0. But that was pretty error prone, so we require a default case because we think it will make people have less debugging issues. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's our not halt sort of mux. But another part of this is we need to, we want to check what the value of the opcode is from our 10 bytes. How do we get that part of the instruction? So we need to take only those, probably the 4 bits that represent, going to be 0 for a NOP, and sorry, 0 for a halt and 1 for a NOP. If you remember our instruction encoding, we have our NOP is going to be 1, 0, and then a bunch of other, this is the next instruction, and the halt is going to be 0, 0, and then the next instruction in hex. And we probably want to extract this part. We definitely don't want to be trying to like enumerate all the possible values of the next instruction to figure out what's going on. So how do we take our 10 byte output from the instruction memory and only get the 4 bits we care about? So HGLRS has a special syntax for subsetting the bits of a signal. And that looks like this. That we specify the starting bit and the ending bit, and it's inclusive in the starting bit, exclusive in the ending bit. And the bits of the signal are numbered based on treating it as an integer, where the least significant bit is 0. So let's think about applying this to our 10 byte value for memory. So it's going to be an 80 bit integer. Yes, that's kind of weird, 80-bit integer, not 64, but 80 bits because that's how big our instructions are. And we need to extract part of the first byte. And the first byte is going to be the least significant byte because we're going to read it from memory as a little endian 80-bit integer. So let's think about how instructions turn into little endian numbers. So here I have the example of a push instruction. I'm using push because it has one space to fill in, so it's very simple. And let's think about where things go. So we have, it's AF as the first byte, then 2F as the next one. A is our opcode, what we're trying to abstract right now, that part of the instruction. And 2 is the register number, in this case for RBX. So the first memory address for the instruction is going to contain hex AF. The second is going to contain hex 2F. And in little endian, the address with the byte with the lowest address is least significant. So if we're writing in our typical sort of English order where the least significant part goes on the right, then this AF is the least significant part, and the 2F comes before it, and if we had additional bytes, they would go here. And in our bit numbering, the least significant bit is bit 0. So the least significant bit is the least significant part of the first byte, which is this F, which is usually not what people's intuition is, because you would think, oh, it's the first thing when I've seen the instruction listing, so it's probably bit 0. It is, but the opcode is not bit 0, even though we see it listed first in this sort of listing of the instruction. Instead, it is bits 4 through 8. Questions about what's happening here. And I'm going through this because this is definitely a thing people mess up and get very confused by. Yeah?
So if we're accessing the opcode, we want to extract the bits 4 through 8.
So if we're accessing the opcode, you extract bits 4 through 8? Yes. If you extract bits 0 through 4, you're getting the lowest, least significant part of the first byte, which on our encoding table is where our condition codes or function codes are. So one way of reasoning about this is that this table is maybe drawn backwards, and that maybe it would be more intuitive if it was instead drawn with 0 on this side, then 1, then 2, and so on. So our halt would be 0, 0, our NOP would be 1, 0, our R remove Q would be 2, CC, and then RA, RB. But our textbook authors didn't choose to draw the table in this way, which would be more intuitive for the bit numbering, because when you draw it this way, we have a 0, this is bit 0, this is bit 8, this is bit 4, which is not how it works when it's drawn the other way. But they chose to draw it the other way, presumably because this, the other organization is certainly more intuitive for manually encoding and decoding instructions, even though it's less intuitive for our bit numbering of values. So the rule is, so byte 0 here is bit 0 through 7, but the bits, bit 0 is the least significant part of that, which is going to be, you know, that second column, the least significant part of byte 0. And the most significant part is bits 4 through 8. Similarly, and this is the other place where this confusion comes up, the most significant part of byte 1 is bits 12 through 16. So byte 1 is bits 8 through 16. The most significant part of that is 12 through 16. So that's where our A is. And our B is going to be in bits 8 through 12. And I think, yeah, so you can figure it out by saying, what byte is it in? Is it the most or least significant part? It's one way of figuring out. You can draw out the table in this sort of way, where you have make sure 0 is on the side you're kind of expecting, so the bits numbers don't like swap about, because we have bytes with bits numbered in a different order, quote unquote, written in a different order. But whatever you do, just keep that in mind. Any other questions about this? Okay, so that's our Y86 sort of decoding part. So this, as I said, I'm mentioning it because it really trips people up. And most notably, like, the opcode, if you get that wrong, it's pretty obvious, like, nothing works. When you get RA and RB wrong, that's often a lot less obvious. That's why you should keep it in mind. Okay, so now we have syntax to actually select the opcode from the instruction. So, and we have syntax to use that selection to in order to choose what we do. So we can actually end up using that. So here I'm saying i10 bytes, bits 4 through 8. And I'm asking if it's equal to NOP or HALT. So these, NOP or HALT, are going to be our predefined constants. And again, we can look at our list of constants, and you can see that NOP is 1. This is 0B0001 is binary constant 1. B for binary instead of X for hexadecimal. And we have HALT is the binary constant 0. We'll talk later on about why they're written in this way. But, and similarly, we have this for all the other instructions. And this is part of being more convenient for Y86, so you don't have to memorize those numbers. You could have instead looked up, you know, you could instead of this have written equals 1 equals 0, But generally, I would recommend using these constants because it sure makes it easier for you to know what your code is supposed to be doing. So we have our, if it's an up, keep going. If it's a halt, stop. And otherwise, it's an invalid instruction, just which is going to stop but print an error from the simulator. So we can take that program, and I happen to have a copy of that program prepared here. So I have my CPU that does that. Just that CPU. I can run, I have a slightly different version, but it's equivalent, I promise. I can run that on my nops.yo, we'll talk about. And we see it runs for 6 cycles and stops. And our simulator tells us that it halted with a particular set of register values and a particular PC after running for 6 cycles. And there's the other possibility. We have that invalid instruction case. So if I run it on a file which I know has an invalid instruction in it, namely any instruction we don't implement, we'll get, it will stop running at that point, but we'll get a different message about it. Okay. So, all right. Okay. So any questions about this example? So we can take the same principle we used here of having of building muxes that do things based on the opcode, and we can use this to implement those various other CPUs we've talked about. Let's start with the simplest one we actually talked about building, which was our nop versus jump CPU. And here I've done some shortcuts to make things simpler. So I could write I 10 bytes of 4 to 8 over and over again. So it turns out we need that a whole bunch. Instead, I'm going to declare a wire called iCode. And I'm going to set that to I 10 bytes of 4 to 8. And I'm going to use that several times in my muxes rather than keep typing I 10 bytes of 4 to 8. And I'm going to do the same thing with a wire for dest, the name which is going to be the name of the 64-bit value of the address we're jumping to, which I get from bits 8 through 72 of the instruction. And also with valp, which is the name I'm going to give to this value, to this value here. To this value here. Just for my convenience, I could have instead gotten rid of LP and assigned this directly to P underscore the EPC. But our textbook likes using valp for that because there's other reasons you might want to use that value. And you can see that you can name things that way. We have our dest, so we have our default case. So this is worth pointing out. So here I have a default case where I have this ridiculous value. I recommend doing something like this. So if it turns out that you end up executing code at the address bad, 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 you know what happened. You know you used the default case in this mux. Whereas if you made the default case like a 0 and you start executing code at 0, you're going to be like, huh, why did we jump back to the beginning? Is there a jump instruction I missed? Like, it's going to be less obvious what happened. So this is our instruction, our simple nop jump CPU. And we can take that and run up. And run that. So here I have a nop jump CPU. And we obviously need a different program to run with that. So here is here is a program I can actually run. So I'm going to convert that into, jump.io, which I've already done apparently, and then I'm going to take my jump CPU and run that on that. No, you can see it runs, and if we look at our what happened, we can verify that it did what we expected by looking at the addresses of the PC. We see that after the first knob, we go to, from 0 to 1. After the next instruction, which HTLRest helpfully disassembles for us into a jump, we should go to 13, and that's in fact what we do. Okay. So questions about how that worked? Okay. So another notable thing we could do with this file that pointing out is that maybe you don't have a testing file yet, and you'd like to verify that your file has correct syntax. There's a way of doing that with HTLRest with the minus check option. So even if I didn't have a testing file, I can still run check the syntax, and it will tell me syntax okay. And HTLRest, it should give you kind of reasonable error messages maybe when your syntax is bad. Right. And also worth pointing out is that we said a header not jump.io. So this is the first case where we've had multiple byte instructions. So let's look at what that looks like. So that's what the format looks like for our jumps. You can see that the assembler, in fact, computed the address, and it writes it all in one big number. It doesn't actually space separate it, I'm sorry. And if you look carefully, this is actually, it's not written as a number in hexadecimal, it's written as a sequence of bytes. Because we know the jump instructions all start with 70 as the first byte, so that's the first byte here. Even though if this was a little endian number, it's not the most significant part of that number. And similarly, that means that this jump to address 13, we have 13 is the first byte of the address because it's address 13, so it's written first, even though that's the least significant part of the value. And I think that's where I'll leave off today. A little ahead of the other section for some reason.